Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What accounts for the inseparable partnership of humans and dogs? And how has that relationship shaped the development of humankind? John Franklin came to a love of canine companions later than most when his then fiancée convinced him to adopt a puppy. But over many fond years with poodle Charlie, this Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer found himself thinking about their relationship as a scientist would, wondering how these animals, descended from wild and deadly wolves, managed to make themselves welcome in our homes and our hearts. And although the subject has received far less attention than you might imagine given our fondness for dogs, Franklin's research did turn up some fascinating theories on man and dog and how they have shaped one another over thousands of years. John Franklin is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I think one of the most surprising things that I learned from your book is how little study has been devoted to this relationship between humans and dogs. Where is the roadblock?
Well, that was the one of the early things that just made me think, hey, there's something really, really wrong here, because you know, we're a society that, I mean, we study everything, and but we don't study dogs, and particularly not for themselves. And I have a passage in, an interview in the book where I'm talking to the leading authority on the paleontology of dogs, and he had just decided to give it up, and he's gonna study goats instead.
Because there's more money in studying goats.
Yeah, he says, you know, I can get money to study goats. I can't get money to study dogs. And yet the dog, as you... the thing that pulled me into this in the beginning was once you know, I became focused on a dog, and she didn't convince me that was the deal. you know, love me, love my dog. So it just... all of a sudden, I saw all those dogs, which I didn't see before. You know, I saw them, but I didn't see them. And, you know, I started looking around. I realized that, boy, it's like that for everybody. I mean, it's certainly the most numerous human companion we have. It has had in the past an incredible utility, but at the moment, it's mostly, at least what you see, it's a cause of trouble, but we won't give them up, no matter what.
Even though, for the most part, they're not really doing jobs for us anymore.
Well, that's true, except as you start to look at it carefully, you realize, oh, yeah, they are.
Yeah, talk about that for a minute. What in the current environment, and maybe for thousands of years, humans and dogs do for one another?
Well, that's a real difficult question to answer, and I'll tell you why. I think I know the answer, but the book is written... this became a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. And the book is first person. It's the first time I ever did that. And it's a mystery. And the answer doesn't make sense unless you follow the clues. So if I gave you the quickie answer, it would just seem foolish until you saw the background. I can say that, and so I've sort of my agreement with my publisher is I'm not going to tell anybody Butler did it, right?
Well, we won't spoil it for anybody, but we'll take the path anyway. You write about the idea about the assumption that true symbiosis is considered a rare thing in nature. Do you believe that in fact there is a symbiosis between human beings and canines?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Which is the center of the answer, but how you get there is really fascinating. stop think about it. We're during the time frame we were dealing with, human beings were they were hunters and gatherers, but they were not anywhere near predators of the status that the wolf was. And I'm sure that wolves preyed on early humans. Everything else did. And then, you know, a few hundred thousand years later, you see these two animals who ought to be enemies have become necessary to each other. Dogs can't live without us. We think there are stray dogs, and of course there are, but we assume that they just live a normal life. They don't. They very rarely live beyond 2 years. If they don't have they have to have a human. And we've also found that humans who have dogs live longer than humans who don't.
For a long time, John, scientists sort of assumed that humans, early humans, sort of deliberately domesticated dogs. What's the case against that theory?
Well, practically no one who really thinks about it believes that anymore. Because in order to do something like that, you have to have some sort of an idea. You have to get an idea somewhere that it can be done.
The precedent for this.
Yeah. And once you've seen a wheel, you can build wheels, okay? but there was no instance of domestication in their world, unless you want to look at, you know, ants and ant cows, which they wouldn't compare themselves with. So it would have been absolutely unthinkable to bring this animal, this dangerous animal, and, you know, just like dogs, I mean, they could tear your arm off. They don't. You don't ever expect them to, but they could. So, you know, would you bring an animal like this into your household? Would you leave it alone in a room with your baby? It would be unthinkable, and that's why the conclusion. Well, there's another point I ought to make is that you can't tame wolves. There's been, you know, with this in mind, there have been a number of people who have tried to tame wolves, and it's never been very satisfactory. And a lot of people have gotten hurt, and I think one woman was killed.
Yeah, this was people trying to prove that, in fact, you could tame a wolf, and therefore that would explain the whole evolution.
Yeah, And so then they tried wolf-dog mixes, and it wasn't any better. It was a little worse, if anything. And yet, when you look at the genetics of it, the difference between a Great Dane and a Pekingese genetically is supposedly less than the difference between someone who in one of the eastern races or one of the western races, you know, us and someone who grew up in someone who was conceived in Mongolia. I mean, these animals are really, really close, and yet they're so different in behavior as well as
appearance and,
yeah,
and everything else.
Yeah, you know, size and shape, and you know, there are certain breeds that you can say you can never say anything with absolute certainty, but you can say that's going to produce a mean dog if you're not careful. And there are other breeds, you know, I think particularly of the golden retriever that. It's simply a very happy dog, you know? And you cannot make one unhappy without doing really weird things to it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why it's so popular.
John Franklin is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer whose new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. Let's talk, John, about the conditions that would have motivated wolves to follow early humans as they moved about.
Well, we know that there was an association between wolves and humans as long as 300 years ago. 500,000 years
okay.
ago. And wrote this stuff down, but I don't necessarily remember it. When we can find intermingled remains of the two, but the one that strikes me and strikes everybody, I think, is that there's a place in France called the Lazarette Cave, and I think there's a town called Lazarette, and I'm probably mangling the way you pronounce it, but it's in the south of France, and 150,000 years ago, early humans lived there, and they had partitioned off the inside, and so it was a number of living quarters,
right,
and at the entrance to each living quarter, there's a skull of a wolf.
Hmm. And what does that tell you?
Well, it certainly tells you that the two were certainly aware of each other. I mean, you can let yourself go and speculate on that, and wolves were clearly totems. Hmm. And as they remain today.
Well, one of the things that you found might have happened was that these early humans who, in many cases, were still spending some time up in trees and things like that, were dropping things down occasionally. And this was an excellent sort of low energy requirement food source for wolves who might follow.
Do
I have this incorrectly?
Yes. The times they were in the trees were a million years and more before that. But what I was pointing out was that if you're an animal and you live in trees, you have some waste. You just let it drop down through the leaves and it's gone. And as a result, there was never any need for these animals, our ancestors, to evolve any way of dealing with the messes they make, and which is why the human race today. I mean, if you look around, we're all trailer trash. I mean, we produce more trash and then just walk off and leave it.
And dogs, of course, later on after they came out of the trees, wolves were good for picking up this trash.
Yeah, they would. So humans would go along making the garbage, and if you had a wolf, I'm sure this happened many times, not just once.
Let me stop you there for one second, John. We need to take a quick break. I definitely want to talk more about this after the break. John Franklin is with us. His new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Franklin. His new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. John, before the break, you had started to tell us about the fact that wolves, being the smart animals that they are, would have noticed that human beings sort of left things around in their path.
Some wolves, probably wolves that were injured or for one reason or another didn't have a pack, and boy, you know, the lone wolf is a very unhappy and short-lived wolf. They would obviously follow people and pick up whatever edible that they left, and it looks fairly obvious to me that by several hundred thousand years ago, they're probably all the bands of humans had packs of wolves following them, and they were probably by that time. Well, in the first place, they were dependent. They weren't just any wolf. They were a wolf that was born into this. And they were a source of food. And I say that women probably are the ones who domesticated wolves, because you decide you want a puppy for supper, or, you know, a cub. So Mama takes a club and, you know, wades into this pack of undomesticated animals, but animals that aren't going to mess with her because they're afraid of her. And you know, some of the puppies snarl at her, and some of them lick her hand and wag their tails. Which one is she going to bash in the brains? Which one does she bash their brains out?
So the gentler ones survived to adulthood, and
that's right.
And the rougher ones were taken out of the mix.
That's right. And over a very long period of time, you start to get a creature that their brains are wired differently. They're evolving.
Their brains are wired differently, and their bodies start to change. You talk about one of the most notable differences between wolves and any other sort of domesticated dogs has to do with the length of their snouts.
That's right, and it was apparently, let me expand this. The length, how humans view the length of a snout is really interesting. There was a study done once where early drawings of Mickey Mouse were followed through until today, and with every year, his nose got shorter. because people discovered that it made him more popular, it made him more lovable. The ones with the shorter noses were more likely to survive. So
in other words, it's no small thing that wolf cubs are cute.
Absolutely not. Of course, wild wolf cubs are cute, too. And it seems like we're not the only species that likes short snouts. Other species do as well. They identify it, as we probably do, with being juvenile. And nature likes a child of any species, it seems like, though it doesn't necessarily treat them that way. But humans, and in Australia they still do this. They will pick up a young dingo and bring it back to the camp, and it'll be their dog, and it'll act like a dog, and you can train it like a dog, But you get to a certain point in his life, you know, past puberty, and then he disappears, and he never comes back. So there's a difference between young animals and old animals. And there's a big behavioral difference if an older animal retains the behavior of a younger animal. And in this case, what's important is that wolves don't bark. Dogs bark.
And do wolf cubs bark?
Wolf cubs bark. And if you stop and think about it, and so far we've got the wolves following the people, and it's doing the people some good, and it's doing the wolves some good. But I think that the really magic moment was when you got a wolf that barked. Because these people were living in very hostile, in very hostile places, and you know, there were everything from bears to tigers to lions, but the most dangerous thing probably was their fellow humans. And if you live in a place like that, somebody got to stand watch. And I was in the Navy, and I had to, you know, stand watch. And when you lose 5 hours of sleep, say between 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock on a mid-watch, you're not worth a darn the next day. And if the dogs will bark, which they will, then that one person doesn't have to stand watch. And since you probably only have a few people in the band, you know, 10 or 20, and probably only half of them are capable of standing watch, a lot of energy can be put into that. And suddenly it didn't have to be.
And even in the middle of the night, when neither wolves nor humans see particularly well, their hearing is so acute that they would know that someone was coming from a distance.
Yeah, except actually with the dog, it's not the hearing. I mean, the hearing is good. But it's the smell. A dog can smell about 250,000 times as well as we can. A dog can smell around corners. Doesn't have to see the thing. Doesn't have to hear it.
So they knew what was approaching by smell.
Yeah. Yeah. The dogs, you know, we understand the other four senses, but the sense of smell, which of course we don't really have, we have a little bit, but negligible from a dog's point of view. We really didn't even start studying scent until the last 20, 25 years or so, and we're just getting started, but. But the interesting thing is that the nose, the cells in the nose that pick up the scent, are directly connected to the brain. They're the only nerves that actually penetrate the brain. The other nerves have to go through sort of a bureaucracy of nerves. So not only can a dog smell, it cannot not smell. It's compelled to pay attention to that world, and that's why it's, you know, one of the most horrible things that can happen to a human being is to lose his sight, because sight means it means so much to us. We're an animal that used to jump from tree limb to tree limb to tree limb, and if there's anything wrong with our eyes, we're going to fall. So we have just incredibly good eyes and no nose at all to speak of. When a dog goes blind, we feel sorry for the dog. And, you know, it's not that big a thing for the dog. I mean, it is and it isn't. But it'll walk into a wall. But it's pretty, in terms of what's going on around it, biologically, it hasn't lost much. It still understands that stuff.
John Franklin is my guest. His new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go now to Karen in McKinney. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
And hello, John. This is that, Karen.
Hello.
John's my brother-in-law.
Oh.
John, I enjoyed your book very much. I finished it this morning, and I just wanted to say that I was really amused by some of your talk about the choices people make in the dogs they select and the behavior of the animal itself being a reflection of the psyche of the owner. I certainly have observed that many times over the years myself, and I was wondering, when you hear stories in the news, like it was a few weeks ago now, about a dog that attacked the owner's mother, and the dog was considered a dangerous animal and was locked up for, I think, 18 months, and the family fought tooth and nail to bring that dog home, and of course, that created a lot of strain in the relationship between the owners and the woman that was attacked, the wife's mother. And, you know, we sit there thinking, what are they thinking? Where are their priorities? And maybe they're showing us that. I just wondered if you cared to comment on that. And then there's also a piece of me that goes, okay, but hey, what if this dog really did snap? Could there be an underlying psychological disorder, even in dogs, that could cause some aberrant antisocial behavior?
Thanks for your call.
The answer to the second question is oh, yeah, dogs have psychoses just like I suppose any animal does. There are even dog shrinks, and don't laugh about it. There are a lot of them, and they are very learned, and they work with expensive dogs, and they help fix them sometimes. Their record is no better than record of human psychiatry, unfortunately. But, you know, you have to remember now, you know, a dog was a wolf. So most of its mind, just like most of our mind, you know, is monkey think. And most of their mind is wolf think. And in the process of them becoming domesticated, they have lost a lot of those genes and a lot of those psychological mechanisms that would make them attack. And I mean, when you stop and think about it, you've got millions of dogs out there. We have some in the neighborhood that stand up to my waist, and probably outweigh me, and I'm a pretty big guy, and that dog could kill me in an instant. He always comes running when I go out, and I, he jumps at me, and now that I know him, I put out my arms, and we say hello, and he runs his tongue across my face, which is awkward if you have glasses on. but I mean, that dog is a killer. So it's not, what's really fascinating to me is not how much problems people have with dogs, but how much problems they don't. We've got an animal here that has the capacity to be extremely dangerous, and yet they aren't. Although, you know, sometimes they are, and We have a lot of problems with the way we've grown up as a dog society. Practically all societies have. And the dog was useful on the farm, and then you bring them in, and you and they become part of the family, and you love them. During World War II, the Japanese decreed that all pets would be killed because they were eating food that people needed to eat it.
And in fact, people risked their lives to keep their dogs.
That's right.
Yeah. John Franklin is with us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, and his new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Franklin. His new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. John, something pretty dramatic took place in terms of human evolution, and I guess it was around 12,000 years ago. Our brains actually got smaller after eons of expanding.
Yes, that's that's something that anthropologically is a really, really uncomfortable subject because I learned it in college and I was uncomfortable, and so was the professor who taught me. But somehow our brains got smaller, and the dog, as the wolf became the dog, its brain got smaller. And it turns out that any domesticated animal, its brain becomes smaller. So it looks like at about 12,000 years, we and the dog, there were no other domesticated animals at the time, wouldn't be for thousands of years, we both lost brain matter.
Did we domesticate each other?
Sure looks it, doesn't it?
Hmm.
I can't think of any other explanation for that.
So, in other words, dogs were doing things that allowed us to have smaller brains?
Yes, in part. And we were doing things that allowed them to have smaller brains. I'm getting awfully close to saying the butler did it. But, it was about that time that I started realizing that symbiosis was as big a force in nature as speciation, which is the division of species. And it turns out that most of the cells in the human body are not, in fact, human. There are other things that are there. Read that the other day in a science magazine and haven't had a chance to follow it up, but I'm certainly going to. So then it was probably 3,000 or 4,000 years until all of a sudden there were pigs and goats and all sorts of things were and herd animals were domesticated. And what was happening ecologically during that period was the Ice Age was coming to an end. And the Ice Age was an age of giant mammals. We have a few of them left. but we used to have giant sloths and giant wolves and giant just about everything. But there wasn't, because of changes in the weather pattern, the Earth just was not nearly as rich in protein. And the wolf, the humanized wolf, could keep the other wolves away from the caribou, which was the natural form of food. So they were the that's what these people and these animals mostly lived on, including the wolves. And you know, people have said that the dog was a turncoat wolf, and yeah, that's pretty true.
John Franklin is my guest. His new book is called The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Lori in Fort Worth. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I just wanted to call in. I'm really totally enjoying your program today because I'm a person who was previously a total non-dog person, and until my husband convinced me that we needed to have a dog, and now I'm so enamored with dogs that I can't see straight.
It only takes one. Isn't that funny?
Well, now I have two, and, you know, my life, these dogs rule my life. But I wanted to comment on something that was said at the top of the show about very little study having been done. And I just find that, and I hadn't noticed that until you made the point. And I live in a neighborhood full of dog lovers, and we spend huge amounts of time out in the front yards talking about our dogs and speculating on why they behave the way they do and how they are able to manipulate us. And so I just wanted to comment on that and also to let your guests know that I definitely plan on purchasing his book because I'd love to see if there's any more insights into that. So I just wanted to express that, and I'll hang up now.
Thanks so much for your call, Laura. And I can say, John, you talk a lot in the book about that sort of social relationship between dog owners and other dog owners and other dogs.
That's right. That's one of the things that you know, once you start seeing all these dogs and someone asked a question before that I should probably insert that the oddest thing about all of this is that we don't see the dogs. If we saw the dogs, we would do research on them. But it's like they've always been there, and they're about there's a lot of research done on cockroaches, but like the cockroach, they're with us always, since we don't see them, we also aren't very logical about them. And Karen, I think mentioned earlier about the cases of dog attacks. And when you think about this long enough, the dog does what the human wants it to do. The dog wants to please. That's the adaptation of the dog. But we hold the dog responsible and not the owner. If it was anything else, if I took a gun and shot my neighbor, I'm responsible. If I train my dog to go over and attack my neighbor, I'm not responsible. If I have, you know, I'm allowed to have a dangerous dog. And it's something that we have to come to terms with, because I'll tell you one thing that I have become absolutely convinced of. If we ever go to the stars, there will be a dog on the spaceship. they are forever. We're going to always have dogs because they're part of us.
Well, we've sent them to space, right? But solo, so far.
Excuse me?
Didn't we've sent them to space right back in the early 60s? But they went solo.
Oh yes, Yes, the Russian, I can't remember the name of the dog, but
it was Laika.
Yeah, that's right. You have a great memory for that. I'm afraid I don't.
Got a note from my producer on that, actually.
Okay.
John, why do you think that, this is really interesting to me too in the book, that, you know, we think of ourselves as teaching dogs to understand what we're trying to say to them, but you make the point that we also have, without realizing it, have learned to speak dog. We've learned to read and interpret what they're trying to tell us.
That's right. Dogs have a language. It's not as complicated as ours, but it's you might think about it as a pantomime language, but if it's even got syntax. That is, if a dog bows with his rump up and its feet out and its head down, that means all that follows this is play. Then he gets up and he attacks you. And you can be real sure that he's it's a play fight. He's not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
There are, you know, dogs develop ways of I need to go out. And then they learn that that works, and they develop ways of saying they need to go out when, in fact, they want to go out.
Yeah.
There was something wonderful is going on out in the front yard. They want to check it out.
You know, my dog has to take medicine every day, and it comes with a treat. And actually, every night around the same time, before we think of it, she comes and sort of asks for it, and we know exactly what she means.
Oh yeah, and isn't it strange that, well, you know, it's partly context.
Mm-hmm.
It manipulates the context. You see the dog behaving in a certain way, and I guarantee you, you may sense that that's the normal dog, but he's doing something. He's doing something to make you realize that it's time for this to happen. We don't speak very well emotionally. We're not, and you know, that's one reason we have so many problems. Wolves will kill each other, but they don't have wars. And so dogs can manipulate us emotionally. And we don't even know it. And the thing is that almost in all cases, they manipulate us towards being happy. Because if you think about it, their survival is dependent upon us being happier with them than without them. And we've somewhere in that 10% of what we've lost, we need it, and this dog has it.
This is not telling anybody the butler did it, but you have a great story at the end of the book about something that your dog Sam did for you and your wife. Will you share that with us?
Sure. We had just moved up to Maryland not very long ago, and we moved into a house where the air conditioning wasn't terribly good, and the bedroom was upstairs, so we had a walk-in basement, so we moved the bedroom downstairs. We were sleeping in the basement, and it was 6:30 in the morning, and we were both in a deep sleep, and you know, one of those, like, drug sleep. Sam started barking and just raising hell. And Lynn just pushed him away and, you know, go leave me alone, and turned over. And he grabbed her by the arm and literally pulled her out of bed, at which point she got awake enough to where she was hearing a terrible burr, burr, burr kind of noise. And we got up and checked it out, and it was the service box had shorted, and we basically had just a huge electrical torch in that room. And we got out of there just as the windows were blowing out of the house. I mean, Lynn couldn't even go back to get a purse.
So the dog saved your life.
The dog saved our life. And after while we were waiting for the fire truck, and it's a rural area, and they got lost, but it didn't matter. I went over. I sat on the wood pile and watched the fire. And there I was with no marshmallows. And realized, you know, Lynn and I are past the age of reproduction, but I wonder how many people there are who would not have had children because
they're dogs. Yeah. John Franklin is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of The Wolf in the Parlor, The Eternal Connection Between Humans and Dogs. John, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.